You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Not all that long ago, when you went on a vacation, you probably sent a postcard to mom, dad, a close friend. Maybe you grabbed one with a photo of the place you were visiting, wrote a quick note on the back. Maybe "Wish You Were Here" was featured on there, slapped on a really cheap stamp. A few days later, it gets delivered. The recipient gets excited with that fun piece of mail, and they get to read the personalized note. Maybe they even saved it and put it in a box. But now that we have smartphones and easy access to email and social media, are postcards still relevant? Our next guest says yes. She's got a new book coming out on the history of postcards, all the different industries that are involved with making them happen, the role they played in the past and present. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you still send postcards? Why or why not? How do you feel when you get them, if you do? Is there a particular postcard you remember sending or receiving? Do you have that treasure trove, a box of your own or someone else's postcards? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lydia Pine is an affiliate researcher in the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. She's the author of Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Lydia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
I mentioned that treasure trove, that box of postcards, maybe from a family member. You had one of those, right?
Yes, I started this project with one of those boxes. And since I've been working on this project, have been gifted with several more. Excuse me. It seems that the once family members find out that you're interested in the postcard project, they keep coming. They recirculate, if you will, which is awesome. But yes, my interest in this project really was sparked by having been gifted this box of postcards from the turn of the 20th century, and looking through postcards that my great grandfather had received, and just sort of starting to think about all of the different ways that postcards function as a social network.
You write that postcards are the largest class of artifacts that humankind has ever exchanged. Can you give us a sense of the scope, especially in the heyday of the postcard?
Yeah, it really shocked me to realize just how many postcards have been made and sent and printed and read and received going around the world. So historians estimate that in the first two decades of the 20th century, so 1900 to 1920, something like 200 billion, so billion with a B, postcards were in global circulation. And when I came across that, that really set me back to just think about the sheer amount of work and labor and ideas and technology that go into all of the parts that are required to send a postcard. As you said, we have to find a stamp. We have to have it delivered. We have to print it. We have to buy it and send it, and somebody has to receive it. And thinking about 200 billion artifacts in circulation was really mind-blowing for me.
You dig into the meaning of postcards, what it means that we embrace these and sent them. And there's a tip here in your subtitle, our first social network. Can you talk about that idea of sending these cheap postcards, quick, cheap, easy to send, as a sort of social network?
Yeah, one of the things that has been fascinating to dig into with this project is the idea that there's a sender and a recipient. And it's not just sort of performative tourism of, oh, look, here I am, I sent this postcard, and here's my demonstration that I went to this really cool touristy thing. But there's also the sort of material life of the postcard, that it's received. Some people save them, some people don't save them. And there's this sense that the postcards are forming the lines of networking that I think we reenact over a century later with digital social networks like Twitter and Instagram. The idea that there's a post and that people respond to it, or the idea that that there's an image and that it sort of has this sense, like there's a really good sort of Instagram aesthetic. There were really good postcard aesthetics 100 years before. And so I think that there are a lot of the similar ways that social networks function that we think about today. A lot of the precedents for this were set down by this older social network made up of postcards.
One thing that really struck me, I think of postcards mainly as, you know, the thing you send when you travel. They were big in rural America as kind of this lifeline of communication. Can you talk about how it swept rural communities across the U.S.?
Yeah, it's such a fascinating story. So in 1909, the U.S. Post Office was in danger of going bankrupt. That they were something like $17 million in the red, and it was really quite grim. And 2 years later, in 1911, they're actually running a surplus. They're running something like $200,000 of a surplus. And there's this huge question of, well, what happened? What happened in 2 years that could turn around the postal situation like that? And the historian Daniel Gifford had gone through the postal archives to figure out that it's simply the sheer number of postcards that are being bought and sold and sent through the United States Postal Service at that point. And so, excuse me. And so one of the big ways that this really turned was it was establishing connections between rural people in rural America with people in urban America. And so there is this sort of networking effect that's happening.
We're talking to Lydia Pine about her new book out next week, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. David is with us in Madison. David, hi.
Yeah, hello. How are you?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about, David?
It's kind of neat. I was going through my dad's stuff, you know, right down to the fishing tackle and the last of the stuff. He passed a while ago. And one of the things that was in there, it was a cardboard, I'd call it a can, and it had like a tin top and a tin bottom to it. And I opened it up, and there was a postcard inside, and it said, "Send your used gold here." And, you know, they would buy it back for 35 cents an ounce or whatever. But there was a penny postcard in there, so that had to be like from the 30s or 40s maybe. I just thought that was kind of cool with the penny postcard, though.
Interesting, David. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah, Lydia, a lot of postcards were sent for personal communication. A lot of them, you write, were for advertising or business schemes like the one David's dad, it sounds like, ran across.
Yeah, if I could just jump in with that. Yeah. I'm so excited that David had that example to share, because certainly postcards were an incredibly cheap form of advertising. And lots of companies did things like that to advertise either personal businesses or to advertise for their company. And it really was fairly ubiquitous. One of my favorite examples that I folded into the introduction of the book was a postcard that was sent out by a church in Kansas that was reprimanding people for not attending services. And so this idea that there's advertising or there's some sort of like, not just, hey, wish you were here, there's certainly that element to postcards as well.
Yeah, our producer Bill Martin's liked to one that you printed saying, hey, we all felt bad you didn't make it to Sunday school last Sunday. Hope to see you next week.
Exactly.
The guilt card. I love it. Thanks, David, for sharing that with us. We'll go next to Madeline in Rice Lake. Madeline, hi.
Hi. So I just wanted to share a little story of my parents and I, before I got married, my parents and I took a last trip of me being single, and we went across Lake Michigan in the SS Badger ferry. Mm-hmm. And in the gift shop, they had a thin little wooden postcard. And I thought, I want to send this to my fiance. And it was so cute. I wrote a little letter, and it was such a cute little postcard. I told him, hang on to this, because when we're married and we have our little home, like, I would like to have this as decor. And I have it now in a little cabinet tucked away, kind of cute.
I love it, Madeline. Thank you so much for sharing that. Sentimental value, Lydia, not just for Madeline, but for a lot of people on maybe that particular postcard.
No, exactly. That there really is this sort of resonance in it. And it's not just building any kind of network. It's really building this personal network and this personal connection. And it's sort of like this material manifestation of, hey, here's this thing. And I remember doing this thing. So that's a brilliant example.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about the history and the present of postcards with Lydia Pine. She's an affiliate researcher in the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas at Austin and author of the new book, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you send and or receive postcards to this day? Do you have fond memories of doing it in the past? Do you have a collection of your own or maybe a family member's in a box? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Lydia Pine about her newest book, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Fountain City. John, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, John?
Years ago, a very good friend of mine started a postcard chain letter idea. And he set up groups that you could pick a theme, and you would get postcards from all over the world, all over the country. I got a huge stack of them, and it was a great, fun project.
And, John, have you gotten some ones from around the world?
Oh, yeah, from all over Europe, Africa, Soviet Union in those days.
I love it, John. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Lydia, you have been on a postcard sending mission, I understand, as part of your research for the book.
So, as part of the research for the book, but also just out of, I loved sending and receiving postcards as a kid and decided that I wanted to do the same with my nieces and nephews. Who are thoroughly in the Gen Z demographic. And it was this utter novelty when I started doing it a couple of years ago when I started this research project. And it's been really fun for the kids to receive and to start sending them. That's been the other fun thing to sort of build the network back the other way is to be able to have them start sending some postcards to me as well.
Thanks a lot for that call. We had an email from Greg who says his father passed away some years ago, was an avid postcard collector. Greg says he's held on to his collection, not knowing what to do with it, apart from a few he wants to personally keep. He wonders, you know, can you get these appraised? Or can you sell these things or at a minimum donate them so that someone can enjoy them as much as his dad did? There is, a collector's market, but there's a lot of postcards out there, right, Lydia?
There are a lot of postcards out there. I know that some public libraries are interested in collections and just sort of building their own picture archives. Some historical associations are interested in building those. Some folks opt to sort of disassemble personal collections like that through eBay or Etsy. So I think that those seem to be the most popular, the popular options for what to do with the collection if you don't want to keep the shoebox.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Susie is on the line in New Berlin. Hi, Susie.
Hi. I called in postcards are really important to me. And as an art teacher and an art therapist, I use postcards a lot. But here's one thing. In talking to a friend of mine, we haven't lived near each other since we were 18, but have known each other for 59 years now. And she just told me that she has saved every single postcard and letter I have ever written to her.
Aww.
And so, and I remember writing a lot of those postcards from, you know, family vacations all the way up until taking our kids on family vacations, you know, and I stopped sending them too much these days, but still send them once in a while. So anyway, she's got my life in a shoebox.
Susie, thank you so much. That reminds me, Lydia, a big point you make is, you know, a postcard on a shelf is one thing, but it really becomes something based on, you know, what we do with it, who we send it to, the message we write, and what they do with it when they get it.
Yeah, one of the things that's been really interesting about this project is the sense that I tell people about it, and the first thing folks say usually is, well, does anybody send postcards anymore? And the answer is emphatically yes, people do send postcards. So, for example, in the last couple of elections, postcards to voters have been really popular. There are programs that you can arrange to have postcards sent on your behalf. People still send them sort of almost in defiance of fast communication to say, look, here, we can celebrate the slowness of a postcard. And so it's really neat to see people, I think, embracing the qualities that postcards offer. They don't offer the speed of an Instagram post, but they offer sort of that material connection. The idea that here's this thing and it took this effort and I thought of you.
Thanks so much for sharing that story. We'll go to Amanda next in De Pere. Amanda, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I like to use the cheesy postcards from the 80s, draw pictures on them, and write jokes for my six-year-old nephew and send them through the mail. And he just loves the surprise when the postman brings it.
Is this something you've been doing over the COVID time?
Definitely during the COVID time. And he's just learning how to read. He's in kindergarten. So it's a great way for him to practice those letters.
I love it, Amanda. Thanks a lot for telling us about that. Lydia, what do you think of the story?
Oh, that's brilliant. I think that there's a huge historical precedent for it. Not only is it just really cool and an amazing thing to be doing, but you're tapping into this sort of 150 years of postcards to do it.
Thanks, Amanda, for sharing that with us. We're talking to Lydia Pine about her new book, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Back to your calls now. We've got Paul with us in Toma. Paul, hello. Are you there, Paul?
Yeah, hi.
Hi, you had a story for us, I think, Paul. What did you want to tell us about?
Yeah, well, when my son was in Cub Scouts way back in the mid-90s, I started a program, helped him do a program for his national requirement for one of his badges. And what we did is we sent out postcards to all 50 governors and had them sign a card and send it back to us that said, peace through cooperation. It was because back in the day, presidents became presidents either being governors, senators, or congressmen. But as a result, like I said, he got 47 out of 50.
Wow.
And the three, only three of them didn't respond because we were outside of the state. That was back when we were in Louisiana. So,
I got to ask, did you keep those or did he keep those?
We did for a very long time. Then I became homeless for a while, and I had them with me, and they got lost to the wind. But they were quite the collection. We had Mario Cuomo back in the day, and we had we got a letter from President-elect Clinton, and we got one from the replacement governor of Arkansas, and several of the governors were either died within a year or were convicted. That was kind of.
Thanks a lot. I'm sorry you ran into hard times and had to give those up, but a great story still, Lydia. I love that, writing to public officials and getting responses from most of them.
That's fantastic. I think it really speaks to sort of the ubiquity and the flexibility of postcards as a medium, to be able to have all of these different ways for postcards to be sent and received and to have them intersecting people's lives. I love it.
Thanks for sharing that with us, Paul. We've got Dick on the line in La Crosse now. Dick, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I remember postcards. I was a little farm boy in Iowa back in the 50s. And I would get a postcard from my grandparents who would travel to California, and I would get a picture of the Golden Gate Bridge, or when they went to Mount Rushmore, it would be Mount Rushmore. And so it was the best pictures I ever saw of those kind of historical figures from throughout the states when they traveled. And so I just thought that was very special to have them think of me, but I also got to see something that they saw that was kind of an icon.
I love it, Dick. Thanks for sharing that. And I'm also glad he called, Lydia, because you reminded me. I wanted to ask you about, you know, how places are represented in these postcards that people like Dick's grandparents were sending.
Oh, that's a fantastic segue. And there are two things that come to mind with that. One, certainly there are these famous places like Mount Rushmore or the Brooklyn Bridge or the Eiffel Tower or things like that that become really codified as tourist stops. Through postcards. It's like, hey, I went to this place and I am going to send you this postcard of this famous thing. But there's also, in the early 20th century, postcards are also serving a role in sort of early photojournalism, where real picture postcards that are basically just pictures that are printed on postcard stock are a alternative or an option for the sort of early days of photojournalism. And so for things like the Mexican Revolution or for political rallies and protests and things like that of the early 20th century, postcards become a way of dissembling and being able to sort of make people aware of places and of things that are happening there.
Just in our last minute, you know, 20 years from now, we're not going to open up that box of Instagram posts. Do you worry that we're losing something if a lot of that kind of a quick communication is in this non-physical form that postcards were?
That's an interesting question. And I would say yes and no. That, yeah, certainly, I hope that nobody's printing out my Instagram posts to save the way, you know, I would hope that people would save a postcard. But I also look at how many postcards have been lost, right? That we don't have those 200 billion postcards still with us. And so I think that there will be some things that sort of filter through and are saved. And that's pretty neat.
Lydia, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's Lydia Pine, affiliate researcher in the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. We talked to her about her new book. It's called Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Love to hear more of your postcard stories. You can share them over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Maybe even you can share a picture of one that you've kept or found in that treasure trove from a relative. Again, you can share that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I think we'll have more stories to share later this week. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. As humans, we know we have an impact on our environment, the plants, animals, the atmosphere around us. That's been going on, though, for a very long time. About as long as humans have been evolving, we've been changing the evolutionary paths of our planetary co-inhabitants. Sometimes that's been intentional, sometimes not. Now we have lots of high technology tools that can speed up the process, including different gene editing technologies. We want to hear what you think. We're going to be settling into all kinds of ethical and moral questions. So bring your questions and comments on all the following: cloning, genetically modified trees, plants, animals, food. Ever had an impossible burger? What questions do you have about saving endangered animals, using our tools to prevent further extinctions? What's your vision for a future where humans cohabitate more productively with our natural world? Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Beth Shapiro is a professor of evolutionary biology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She's author of the book, How to Clone a Mammoth. Her latest book is called Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Innovation Refined and Redefined Nature. Beth, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Your book looks at modern biotechnology through the lens of, like I said, 50,000 years or so of human modification of the environment. What led you to look toward lessons from the past for these big decisions we face right now?
Well, you know, my research is in a field called ancient DNA. I work out in the Arctic mostly because that's where DNA preserves better, collecting bones and teeth and hair and stuff like that from plants and animals that used to be alive. And my goal with my research is to understand what made some species or populations more resilient in the face of past periods of rapid climate change, like warming after the last ice age or the first introduction of humans. And what we've learned over the decades of studying ancient DNA is about the tremendous impact that people have had on the plants and animals with which we share this planet. And today, you know, we're facing these enormous decisions that we have to make about how far we are willing to go using our new technologies to try to protect the species and spaces that we appreciate and know around us. And it's useful, I think, to look into the past to understand better how it is that we've been manipulating species for a long time. It helps to think that, to realize that we aren't suddenly moving into the role of manipulating or messing with or really causing species to evolve in a particular way, but have been in this role for some time.
Can you give us a sense of the scope of humans as an evolutionary shaper of the world around us?
Yeah, so in the book, I kind of divided it up into technological periods. So the first evidence that people were really messing with the evolution of other species comes from the fossil records of the continents around the world, where as soon as people start moving out of Africa and into other parts of the world, we see evidence that they are hunting species. Species are becoming extinct. We're changing the landscape, and that's reducing habitat available for species. And this, of course, was not intentional. We didn't turn up. Our ancestors didn't turn up in a place and plan to drive species extinct, but it was a consequence of how we were changing the landscape when people got there. And then somewhere around 10 to 15,000 years ago, it changed or began to change. And this is really the beginning of the, they call it the Neolithic, or the period where you start seeing domestication and agriculture. People realized that the driving species or populations extinct was not an inevitable consequence of finding enough food to keep their families fed, and began to try out different strategies, like not taking animals that were reproductive, taking only males or older females, leaving the females that could reproduce in the population so that that population would survive. And then, of course, the animals that they were hunting came closer. They were brought closer to human settlements. And this was the beginning of herding technology. And through this, we started to learn about animal behavior and reproductive cycles, and really becoming herders and hunters, herders and caretakers, rather than just hunters. And that went on for some time, and we succeeded because of our success in agriculture and farming and in becoming proficient at keeping things like cattle and goats, etc. And there became a lot of us, and all of our animals and plants started taking over all of the wild spaces. And then somewhere between 100 and 200 years ago, we went through yet another technological transformation, where we moved from being herders and hunters and farmers to realizing that if we really want to see other species on this planet, we're actually going to have to become caretakers. And this was the early part of the conservation movement. Now, a lot of people think of conservation as leaving things alone. Let's stand back and let the earth be just fine. But in fact, what conservation is us deciding who gets to survive, who gets to reproduce, where different plants and animals get to live. And as we transitioned to caretakers, to protectors, we took over the evolutionary trajectories of everything that we interact with, not just those species that we consider our domesticates. So it's really been a change. We've gone through several different technological innovations in this time.
Talking to Beth Shapiro, her new book is Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Innovation Refined and Redefined Nature. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Okay, Beth, a big new toolkit now with genetic modification technology, which covers a lot of different technologies, I know. I think people might look at this and say, okay, yeah, we bred animals, or we selectively killed this animal, not that one. Slow changes that took generations to make. Biotechnology feels a little different. We can tweak a gene and have it in the wild by next year. Is there something qualitatively different that should make us think of biotechnology in a different way than all the stuff we've been doing for tens of thousands of years?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it would be unfair to say that there isn't something different about what we're doing now. But we also have to think about the potential benefits and where we've been. I mean, a lot of people are nervous about using gene editing to help to change things that we eat, for example. We can go in and we can tweak a gene and we can make papayas resistant to ring spot virus, which are papaya virus, we're killing the papayas in Hawaii, for example. Or we can tweak a gene and turn something up and down that makes something taste a little bit better. This technology is kind of scary because if we don't really understand it, because we're going in and we're trying to mess with stuff and maybe there's some unintended consequences. What people often don't remember is that the plants and animals that we have today are not just the consequence of very careful selective breeding, but we do things, for example, called radiation breeding, where we'll stick a whole bunch of baby plants into an environment where we just zap them with radioactivity or with chemical mutagens and cause tens of thousands of mutations. And we get things like ruby red grapefruits and renin wheats. These are all products that we're not scared of because they're not genetically modified in any way, but they are products that we have caused tens of thousands of uncharacterized mutations to occur and just pick the ones that we like. So we are doing crazy stuff that isn't genetic editing or genetic engineering that, you know, I mean, there's nothing inherently scary about mutations. That's not why I'm bringing this up, but it's strange to be worried about going in and making one very specific mutation like we can do with gene editing, but not worrying so much about making 10,000 mutations in mutation breeding and ending up with delicious ruby red grapefruits.
Last time time you joined us, we talked about the idea of de-extinction, bringing back, say, a mammoth. And you were excited, more excited, I think, about the idea of using these kind of technologies to prevent extinction. So I want to dig into one case study that's close to my heart, the black-footed ferret, which was really close to extinct, about as close as you can get to being extinct without being extinct. Can you talk a little bit about the black-footed ferret story and where some genetic interventions could make a big difference?
Yeah, this is a great story and one of my favorites. So, you know, black-footed ferrets, they're this little predator that lives across the plains, and they eat prairie dogs. And during the early and middle part of the 20th century, there was this massive prairie dog eradication program because they're nuisances. You know, they can break down roads and infrastructures, and they get in the way of farms. And the successful prairie dog eradication program also was pretty successful at eradicating black-footed ferrets. In fact, black-footed ferrets were one of the original species listed when the Endangered Species Act first came into being. And I think it was the middle of the 80s. They captured the last living black-footed ferrets and put them into captivity and had really very little luck having successfully breeding them in captivity. And they thought they were extinct until a black-footed ferret was discovered near Meteetse, Wyoming. And this was amazing to everyone because they thought this whole species was extinct. And here it was, another opportunity to see if they could figure out how to do captive breeding for the black-footed ferret. So they brought these animals in, and everything looked pretty good for a while. They were finding healthy ferrets in the wild. And then suddenly, they weren't finding any more healthy ferrets. They were only finding sick or dead ferrets. And in a last-ditch effort, they brought as many individuals into captivity as they could and tried to breed them. They had success finally when they got one individual whose name was Scarface. And he was the first male to actually breed any of the females in captivity. And this captive breeding program has been a tremendous success. Black-footed ferrets are released into the wild every year, and those populations are a little bit successful, but there's still one really terrible thing that happens, and that is that black-footed ferrets, when they're released into the wild, they will catch and kill and eat a prairie dog, and that prairie dog is often infected by introduced sylvatic plague. And these black-footed ferrets get plague, and they die. And so there are a couple of options that people have been looking into to try to help black-footed ferrets to survive using the tools of new modern biotechnologies. And the first is that there's a place in San Diego called the Frozen Zoo where there are tissue samples from black-footed ferrets that lived prior to this first near extinction, that were part of this first captive breeding trial program that didn't work. And about a year ago, Revive and Restore, which is a nonprofit out of Sausalito, California, partnered with the San Diego Frozen Zoo and U.S. Fish and Wildlife to start a program to see if they could clone animals from those frozen tissue specimens that are in the San Diego Frozen Zoo. And a few months ago, an individual, a little girl, black-footed ferret kit called Elizabeth Ann was born. And Elizabeth Ann's, her DNA, her genetics show that she is distantly related to all of the individuals that are in the captive breeding program. And she, as soon as she is old enough, will be entered into this captive breeding program and will make an eighth founder individual. Eight founder individuals for the entire living population of black-footed ferrets. So her DNA will be a welcome bit of diversity into this population. But it might not necessarily solve the problem of sylvatic plague. And for that, they're looking elsewhere. So the cousin of the black-footed ferret, the domestic ferret, evolved with sylvatic plague and is naturally immune to it. So this partnership, again, between Revive and Restore, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and several other academic institutions in the San Diego Zoo, are now working to figure out why it is genetically that domestic ferrets can't get plague or don't get sick when they get plague. And once they've discovered that, their plan is to use genetic engineering to introduce that bit of domestic ferret DNA into black-footed ferrets, essentially creating an animal that is 99.999% black-footed ferret and 0.000, some number of zeros, 1% domestic ferret, but that is not able to get plague. And this is an amazing example to me of how these new technologies, including genetic modification and gene editing, could be used to help species to adapt to today's environment where evolution, natural selection, isn't going to be enough for these animals to survive. But we can help them using these tools.
We're talking to Beth Shapiro, professor of evolutionary biology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Her new book is Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Evolution Refined and Redefined Nature. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the idea of using these kind of genetic tools to modify animals to save them from extinction, as we were just hearing about the black-footed ferret there. Do you have questions about this work, how this works, concerns about it? How about genetic modification to fight pollution, to create mosquitoes that die out on their own or maybe don't spread diseases like malaria? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Beth Shapiro from the University of California, Santa Cruz, talking about her new book, Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Innovation Refined and Redefined Nature. Beth, with genetic modification for whatever purpose, preventing extinction, boosting food crop output, whatever the case may be, I think people worry about unintended consequences. At the macro level, we've introduced species to continents where they've been pretty devastating in the past. How do we address concerns about the things we introduce, the things we tweak and modify running amok once they get out into the wild?
It's a really good question, and it's an important thing to think about whenever we think about introducing invasive species. We do, as a species, have a long history of doing stuff like this, releasing a new species, imagining that there's going to be a solution to a problem by introducing an invasive species and then it going amok, as you say. We also have a long history of driving things to extinction by overhunting them or coming up with other solutions. I think what's going to be most important is that we really engage in careful consideration of the possible risks. You know, we can't just make a decision somewhere that impacts the rest of the world. We have to start having these conversations all at once with all possible stakeholders. And, you know, it isn't really possible to do much of this stuff just yet, which is why it's important to start having these conversations now. You know, gene drives, this idea that we can pass a trait, you mentioned resistance to malaria and mosquitoes, through an entire population. One of the ways that this is being imagined is that they would introduce a trait that actually makes the mosquitoes unable to reproduce, right? So they're essentially trying to drive the mosquito population all the way down to zero. But there's also a very long conversation about how you would do this and include what they're calling a kill switch, or a way to stop this from happening. And essentially, that would be, you know, you would edit the genomes that it contains the letters that code for this particular trait, but also letters that you could turn on that stop that trait from happening. Or there's another situation where you put these gene drives in, but you attach them to other drives, and only one of them, and the one at the very end, this is kind of confusing to think about, they call it a daisy chain drive. So what you have is multiple different driving elements in the genome, but one of them doesn't get passed on. And the end consequence of all of this is that the trait that makes half of the individuals that are born not survive only lasts for a fixed number of generations, say 10 generations. So over time, fewer and fewer individuals have that trait, and then hopefully it's been a strong enough drive that the population collapses, but it doesn't stand any chance at all of persisting forever. So it's these kinds of things, kill switches and genetic changes that can't persist forever in the natural population, that people are thinking about when we're considering using these kind of tools for conservation.
A big question is who decides? I can imagine if I'm in one country in a malaria zone, I might make one decision about the mosquitoes. The neighbors across the border might make a different one, and the mosquitoes don't care about the borders. You give a smaller case in your book looking at Lyme disease-resistant mice and bringing together different communities on the East Coast. How are they considering how to decide whether or not to try to fight Lyme disease with genetically modified mice?
So this is a program called Mice Against Ticks. It's led by a professor at MIT, Kevin Esfeld. And he is one of the leading speakers who's really leading thinkers about how we should be able to use gene drive technologies. So the idea here is that people who live in Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket and other islands and along in the Northeast, there's a really high incidence of Lyme disease, which is a debilitating disease. And so nobody wants to get this. And mice are the reservoirs for Lyme disease. So it comes, ticks bite the mice, the ticks bite the people get Lyme disease, the mice are carriers. What they would like to do is engineer mice so that they can't carry Lyme disease, that they're resistant to it in some way. And in this way, they won't be able to reinfect the ticks, and the ticks won't be infected, and then people won't be infected. But Kevin and Mice Against Ticks are adamant that the only way that you could use this sort of technology is if you have buy-in from the local communities. And so he has built these consortiums of people who live on the islands who he is working with so that they can really understand the short-term and long-term and potential consequences of these technologies. And then they are choosing. And so far, they have chosen that they don't want to use gene drives, but they do want to do something about Lyme disease. And so they're still all working together to figure out what the best solution for them is. And I think this is a great example of how scientists and stakeholders can work together. Kevin clearly feels that gene drives have strong potential to be helpful here, but he also understands that you can't just impose your will on a community and that an action in one place is going to also have consequences to other locations. And this is the challenge that we're going to face as we start to think about these technologies. But as I said before, you know, these technologies exist. They will become increasingly powerful, and people will decide eventually that they're going to use them, whether they have global permission or stakeholder buy-in or not. So now is the time for those of us who really believe that there needs to be stakeholder buy-in to start having these conversations so that everybody can understand the technology and can invest in making decisions about what is going to impact them and their children and their communities.
In just our last minute or so, Beth, it seems like the core message of your book isn't even so much about the technology available, but the idea of responsibility. Can you talk about, given how much humans have changed the animal world, the plant world for that matter, make the case that we have some responsibility not just to step away when things go bad?
Well, you know, what I worry about the most is we all imagine when you think about conservation that we either have the choice to stand back and let nature heal on its own, to leave it alone, or to jump in and get our hands dirty. The problem is that it is too late for us to imagine that we can stand back. The pace of change today, the pace of extinction today, is way faster than what evolution by natural selection can keep up with. And this is because of us, because of the impact that we have had on habitats and species around the world. If we want to live in a world that is both biodiverse and full of humans, we're going to have to figure out how to take advantage of these technologies that allow us to meddle with species at a pace that keeps up with the changes that we are imposing on the landscapes around us.
Beth, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you. It was fun.
Beth Shapiro is a professor of evolutionary biology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. We talked to her about her new book, Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Innovation Refined and Redefined Nature.